Time Blong Master, the Australian involvement with Papua New Guinea.
Took 3 days to get to the plantation and chugged up the river through the mangroves and then came out on this wonderful open place where three rivers met. And we got off the Varoi, that was the name of the ketch, walked on duck boards through the coconut trees till we got up to the house, which was on a slight rise, and looked out over the tops of the coconuts and out to the river. And I said to Mother, "Oh, this is the most beautiful place I have ever seen." Mother left one of her more notable silences and then said, very controlled voice, "Wait till you've been here 6 months, dear."
Living on atolls is not the best. Once you've walked around an atoll once, you don't want to do it again. And I used to get a little cynical when visitors would come out and start getting lyrical about tropical paradises. I said, "You live here for 3 months and you'll probably go off your rocker."
I had a general rule that by 7 o'clock in the morning, if three things had gone very badly wrong on the plantation, I'd agree it wasn't my day and I'd go down with a couple of lads and I'd go fishing for the day. And I'd come back and I'd find that the plantation had generally been run a little bit better than had I been there, and I'd feel a lot better.
The Boat Came Every 6 Weeks is the first of two programs on Australian planters in Papua New Guinea. Their plantations produced copra, cocoa and rubber, and in later years in the highlands, coffee and tea. Unlike their counterparts of the British Raj in Malaya or Ceylon, few Australian planters in Papua New Guinea achieved the kind of gracious living they might have hoped for. Few actually owned the land they managed, and loneliness and malaria were often more evident than the image of servants in white serving cool drinks on well-manicured lawns. Dr. Hank Nelson.
Coming from a drought-prone homeland, many Australians were misled by the piles of tangled rainforest and the stands of tall kunai grass. Here, they thought, was a place where anything planted would flourish. In 1906, when the Australian government took control of the territory, a royal commission reported, "The soil of Papua is rich, virgin and easily worked. The rainfall is regular and generous. Streams, ever-flowing and pure as the sources from which they come, are to be met with every few miles." But in fact, nearly all the early Papuan planters struggled. Whatever they could grow, someone, somewhere else in the tropics, could grow cheaper and at less distance to ship to market. Much land that was leased by hopeful white settlers eventually returned to the villages and that deceptive tropical growth. The planters that stayed on occupied scattered pockets of land along the coast, on the Sagere Plateau, and in the islands. Plantation families were acutely conscious of their isolation from the rest of the white community.
The ketch was supposed to come about every 6 weeks with supplies for the household and rice and tobacco and things for the trade store. It was supposed to come every 6 weeks, but it very rarely did. So after about 6 weeks, when we were running short of tea and reading matter and other essentials like that, we'd start listening. There were little creeks running through the jungle and they would magnify the sound of the engines, and we got so that we could hear an engine from miles, hours away. We could hear the beat, and every hornet was an engine or coconut palm, any sound you'd listen for and try and identify it as an engine. And when the boat did come in, and then occasionally the Sir Hubert Murray's government boat, the Larabada, would come up on a routine inspection, and occasionally other boats would come in, and the excitement when you saw somebody that wasn't your own family or the people that lived at the government station was, you know, out of all proportion to what sort of conversation we went in for. And we wrote letters interminably. We kept going, writing letters and posting them off. And when the mailbag came and you tipped it out, and there were lots of letters, and you'd stack them in order of excitement, and people would send us books. And to get some more reading matter was the great thing, so that I suppose we were lonely, but we didn't give it a name. If you gave something a name, it's realer than if you just pretend it isn't there.
The first house I built was made of goru floor, that is a palm tree that grows in the jungle. It was about 30 feet by 20 feet, and that was divided into a mosquito-proof sitting room, which I also used as a dining room. That was probably about 12 by 12. A kitchen at the back and a bathroom and a bedroom. It was very tiny. It was about 5 or 6 feet off the ground. And I had a very nice old carpet snake that used to live in the grass roof, the kunai roof, and that kept the rats down. I had a refrigerator, I had a wooden stove. It was a very primitive life compared to plantation life now, and I suppose looking back on it, it looks quite ridiculous. No one in those days ever dressed at night. You'd come in from the plantation. We worked very, very hard. We'd come in from the plantation about 6 o'clock. We'd have a bath, get into pyjamas, and then your servant would bring out a bottle of Negrita rum, which everybody drank in those days. Nobody ever drank scotch then. Rum, you'd have rum and water. He'd make a couple of savouries. You'd open a newspaper that was generally by then 6 weeks old. There was not very much radio. I had a radio that I used to get onto, the Australian News, but I couldn't always get them with static. The radios weren't as sophisticated as they are now. I'd get in my pyjamas, I'd have my bath, I'd be in pyjamas, I'd drink a rum, and then I'd pour myself another rum and I'd read the newspaper, and suddenly it'd be 10 o'clock at night and I'd have drunk half my bottle of rum. You'd do that without noticing it. How on earth I didn't become an alcoholic, I don't know. It was sheer good luck. I had one chap on one side of me managing a plantation, and he was an alcoholic. He'd go out for 2 months at a time. And there was another chap on the other side of me, a very, very nice man who'd been a patrol officer a long time ago, pre-war, in the Papuan side. And he died of cirrhosis of the liver, and he was pretty far gone when I was there. And I suddenly realised that the way I was living, I was going like them. The drinking until 10 o'clock at night without realising it, because sometimes, apart from these weekends with people, I wouldn't see people very much. And so every night I'd get stuck into it, which was a very wrong thing. So I decided to make a change in my life. I got out of pyjamas and into long trousers, put on a shirt and put on a tie. And I permitted myself 3 drinks a night. And then I set a special time for a meal when I was by myself, and I had dinner every night at 7:30. And I found that suddenly things started to run a little bit better. The house was run with more precision, the plantation seemed to be run with more precision, and I just didn't become an alcoholic.
We observed a certain standard. I mean, we always dressed for dinner. This was largely because we'd got so jolly hot during the day, we liked to have a bath and put on something else. I don't think we wore white tie and tails. We always had a drink before dinner. One. It certainly wasn't luxury in the sense that you read about in Malaya, for instance, or India. That sort of pomp and ceremony, by any means at all.
I ran out of money after the first year, and I had very great difficulty in carrying on. It was then that I had to learn how to live off the land, and I'm very proud of that now because I've realised the beauty of local foods. I regularly eat pumpkin tops cooked with coconut. I know all the local shellfish to eat and fish to eat, and since when I started a plantation, there was only about every 6 weeks, and I couldn't afford to buy fresh meat. I just lived on the local meat. I was a great eater of wallabies, which are quite nice if cooked certain ways. I've eaten many a cassowary, but the local birds, the hornbill, or the boboro as we call it, I think they're called cockamore in pidgin, the breast of that minced makes an extremely nice rissole. The liver is excellent as a savoury before your glass of rum. Taro is a wonderful food if cooked and coconut added to it. Sweet potatoes baked in their skin and eaten with butter and salt and pepper are a superb dish. There are so very, very many things. Igaru, if added to shellfish soup igaru is a vine growing in the jungle, and it's extremely good. I'm very lucky that I early met Kwato people, Kwato Mission, and they'd studied cooking local foods, and it was from them that I learnt how to make them far more palatable. And even now today, after 34 years, I'm very happy to eat local food.
With a boat every 6 weeks, with luck, planters and their families had to be self-sufficient in every way.
A European lady with children, there's always the fear of accident or sickness. My wife's quite competent, but my son, he was only about 3 years old, and he fell, and his top lip was completely split in two parts, and we'd run out of sutures. My wife sewed him up with a needle and cotton, and you can hardly see it today.
Every day on the plantation, when I got up in the morning, I had oil of cloves and I had some sort of chalky stuff that you could make a temporary filling of. And so I would fill all my teeth every morning with oil of cloves and the chalky stuff. And when the dentist had finished with me and I came to eat my breakfast cereal, I couldn't think why it was so tasteless, because I'd been so used to having it flavoured with oil of cloves every morning for breakfast. No, toothache was just something that was there all the time. Every time I ate anything hot or anything cold or anything sweet or anything sour, my face would begin to ache. One day it would be swelled up on one side and on another day another side. And that was how I came to start smoking, because Mother had very, very firm notions about drugs. And even aspirin had to be regarded with great caution, because if it didn't hurt, how did you know you were ill, you see? So palliatives were out, because if you stopped the pain, then you thought you were all right and perhaps you weren't really. She'd had her troubles too, and her pronouncement was, no one should ever come to this country with their own teeth. I think she was probably right, except that if anything should happen to your plate, you'd have been sunk too.
In German New Guinea, there was more land suitable for plantations, and the early planters caught high prices for copra. When the Australians took over after the First World War, some ex-servicemen moved into spacious, verandaed homes set in lush gardens, but then faced falling prices in the general collapse of world markets in the 1930s. Instead of a nation's reward, they got hard work, debt, and malaria. Many of the pre-war New Guinea planters faced the same struggle for subsistence as their colleagues in Papua. Some were forced to sell and became managers on plantations they had once owned. Australian planters probably made their quickest profits in the 1960s, when coffee and cocoa prices were high. In that late evening of plantations, men that had developed their properties from almost nothing 10 years earlier were able to sell for hundreds of thousands of dollars.
In the early 1930s, Norman Sandford went to Bougainville as a cadet plantation manager.
When I arrived at the plantation, I was led to a very, very large house, which had been the residence of the previous manager. The new manager had built himself a newer and much better one, understandably, because in my house, which had a lounge of about 60 by 20, the areas in which one could walk without falling through the floor, which had been white ant ridden, were outlined with chalk. In this lounge, of course, was the dining room, which was a wire enclosed area. The floor of most of that was fairly safe. Out to one side was a corrugated iron kitchen, and I was given two local natives to act as cooks. Fortunately, they had had some training, because although I was quite a reasonable cook myself, having spent many years jackarooing, I couldn't communicate with them very well, not having learned pidgin.
Of course, tinned food in those days wasn't such a much, and of course we had no refrigeration. We had a Coolgardie safe, which is a stand with hessian down the sides and a pan of water on top that dripped down and kept the hessian cool. And it stopped the butter from actually getting into oil, nearly, but it certainly was nothing like a refrigerator would be.
Tenekau Plantation, which is in the Wakanai area. It was about 1,600 acres, all beautifully planted up with coconut trees, no cocoa. It was privately owned, and we had a very small house to live in. We had a little wood-burning stove, which was very old. We had to fix up the side of it. And, of course, where there's no water laid on, we had carried our water up by bucket. And our bathroom was just a room with open shutters. And, of course, we had a bath in a tub, carried the water. And our steps, I think, were just like a post, hopping up onto a post. And then eventually we had steps. My husband made steps. I think going from our living quarters to the kitchen, we walked across a little plank, and the kitchen was corrugated iron, just a half wall. And of course, in this kitchen, we had to do, you know, all our cooking, our making our bread, everything that we ate, of course. We had a little kerosene refrigerator which had the ice block trays, and if we took the covering off the ice block trays, and we could pack in sausages and things that would keep us going for about 10 days. And we had a boat every 6 weeks. So for about 10 days, we had some fresh meat. And then after that, well, we lived on fish and tin meat, cow-cow. Potatoes were a luxury. But we learned to make all sorts of things out of the bush. We learned to make soup from pumpkin tips. And we learned to get pigeons and ducks and different things that people would bring us. It was just amazing the way we did live, you know. Our ironing was done by a big old iron that was like a charcoal burner and had a chimney. And we'd burn the coconut shells on a piece of flat iron and then scoop the coals into this iron, which would heat up the iron, and then we'd do our ironing that way. Our lighting was 12-volt batteries, and this went on for about an hour and a half in the evening, just to give us enough light to perhaps do a little reading and have our evening meal.
For most planting families, social life evolved around the family group and occasional visitors.
Well, on an isolated plantation, it is very quiet, and unless you like that type of life, it doesn't suit people that likes a lot of company and things like that. Because in a plantation, you've only got yourself and your family, and then you've got the labors. You are completely cut off from the outside world.
Mother loved playing bridge, so that whenever she could catch a patrol officer who played bridge, they would make up a four, and we had mahjong. But then you couldn't do very much at night because of the lighting. You see, we had no electricity. We had oil lamps, and we also had carbide lamps. But you can't read at night very comfortably by a carbide lamp. And if you put the carbide lamp in the middle of the table where you're playing cards or bridge, all the moths in the universe would come roaring in and get all over the cards and scatter about. So I don't remember that we needed entertaining much. Mother was a great needleworker, and she saw to it that we did needlework too. And during the day, when I wasn't at the trade store or being taken for my medicinal walk by my father around the plantation, I'd be painting and drawing, and I don't remember that we needed entertaining.
What sort of entertaining happened when visitors came?
You talked, and then you talked some more. And had cups of tea at appropriate intervals and cake, and then you went on to drinks and cheese straws, and then you went on to dinner, and that was all the entertainment we needed, was to have somebody to talk to or listen to you.
The Malaita called every 6 weeks. That's the Burnsville ship. She carried about 100 to 150 passengers. Rumours used to circulate every time the school holidays came, that there'd be 20 or 30 school teachers coming up on the round trip, you see, and all the young overseas were agog. They swallowed that story hook, line and sinker so many times. They never did come up, of course. But there were a few female passengers, and we had our own social life, really. In the early days, We used to take the schooner and go down to the Solomon Islands and play tennis. Our Japanese schooner captain was an A-grade tennis player. Very good indeed. Most of us had our hobbies. We worked tortoise shell and all things that would be counted very boring these days. Collected shells or tried to make radio sets and become hams and all that sort of thing. You know, we were self-sufficient. If you weren't a self-sufficient person, you just didn't go there in the first place. Or if you did, you didn't last.
Weekends, all the plantations would gather together in one house or the other. Well, mine being such a tiny place, mine being a new plantation, very few people came to stay the weekend with me. I'd generally go to Otamata Plantation, which in those days was run by Mr. and Mrs. Miller. Fantastic characters. Cassie Miller was one of the great ladies of the pre-war of this country and of the early years after the war. She was a wonderful hostess. She was a tremendous cook. She was quite a large lady. In 1908, she'd been a Floridora girl. And in those days, to be a Floridora girl or to be on the stage, you didn't need to be the slim little lass you have today. You had to be rather beefy. I suppose you could call her a big girl. But she had a tremendous personality. The whole district would gather along there practically every second weekend. There'd be 8 or 10 of us. We'd all have our bath, a pull-up shower with hot water in it. Then we'd get into our pyjamas and we'd come and we'd sit in the mosquito-proof room and we'd drink rum or gin. Some of the ladies used to like gin. And it was always with water because there were no bottles of the present-day lolly water. And it was the habit in Papua, I don't know about New Guinea, never to drink after dinner, so that you do all your drinking before dinner. Consequently, dinner didn't occur sometimes till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, when we were all as high as a mob of kites, but it was really good fun. And when I look back on it now, those were some of the very happy days of my life. What the cook did, I don't know, but he apparently cooked food for about 10 o'clock, then he just kept the fire going and dozed. And next morning, we were young then, hangovers didn't occur as frequently as they do today. But that was generally the form of entertaining.
Planters who lived near the few large population centres had their clubs, which became bastions of white privilege and exclusiveness. But the clubs often began in very humble circumstances.
The men started to think, well, they could build a little club, and notes went up and down the coast with the mail runner, looking for donations and ideas and suggestions that we're going to build a club in Kieta, and if we ever do get together, well, we'll have somewhere to meet. So this started, and everyone was quite excited about it, and the people living near Kieta, they came in and had working bees, and people donated timber, and they started building it, I think, about 1956-57. And that club is still quite a popular club here now in Kieta today, the Kieta Club. When we had our very first ship that came in to take the cocoa out, the men, of course, were all so excited. They all went out onto the little boat to see the big ship to take the cocoa. And this was where all the women waited with the children. And I remember it went on for several hours, them loading the cocoa and the women waiting at the Kieta Club. And one of the English officers came ashore with one of the husbands. He said he'd like to see Kieta and see the club. And, of course, he got quite a shock because there were no lights anywhere. And the only lights we had in the club were little, what we call sludge lamps. We were burning them off wicks, just in little tins. We were sitting around. Our children were asleep and the wives were just sitting around with these little lamps burning from tins. He'd come ashore thinking maybe, you know, a club, something all lit up. And he must have struggled and slipped from the beach in the dark and finally scrambled up the steps. And we had made little wire cots. We called them meat-safe cots. This was because of the mosquitoes. We always had a couple in the club to put young babies down. And this man just looked around and he saw the club and he saw the children in these meat-safe cots and he said, my goodness. He said, they sit here in the dark with these little lamps and their children are in cages. And he was astounded. He couldn't believe it, that we were all sitting here in the semi-dark. But everybody was very happy because we were comfortable. We had a roof. We felt on mutual ground. It was a club, somewhere where we all met. And perhaps we hadn't seen each other for a year, most of the wives. So this was a very happy time for us.
I mean, if you want to live like a beachcomber, well, you can. There's nothing to stop you. On the other hand, if you want to live in a bit of style, you can too. There's no roughing it, ever. Whiskey was the main drink. And when the visitors came, I suppose you could say, well, that was about the only thing to do, really. You would inevitably offer them a drink, and nearly always they'd have one. Well, I think the climate is, helps that a bit. You seem to need something to back you up a little bit, you know. The climate is a bit, there's no let-up. It's the same every day, you see.
We were generally pretty polite to everyone who came along. After all, we lived a very isolated existence there. All plantations in those days, there was about every 5 weeks. So that generally when someone came along, we were very delighted to see them. But there's an old story that guests are like fish, they tend to smell after 3 days. And all sorts of methods were used to get rid of unnecessary guests. They did hold up work, and quite frankly, we worked very, very hard on a plantation. We had to. I do remember one party on a neighbouring plantation that went on too long, and the guests were still there on Monday night and showed no indication of going. And the host sent his shoot boy, as we called him, the chap with the gun, out and shot a series of flying fox, a dozen or so, which were very easy to shoot, and had them boiled and then served them at breakfast next morning. Each plate had a flying fox with its wings stretched out and a pitying look in its face, and the guests took the hint and left. They've got a horrible smell too, incidentally. Another occasion, a particularly offensive fellow came down and stayed and appeared to be going to stay forever, and I went to the trouble of even chartering a plane and told him that, well, this is the only plane here for the next few weeks, I'm afraid you'll have to catch it. So I drove him down in my car, put him on the plane and said goodbye. We had a lot of work to do, and we just could not afford time off for guests. If they were delightful guests, of course, it was different. You could take them round the plantation for you, but boring guests, well, we had to devise methods to get rid of them.
We built a club, and you could go in and have a drink every afternoon. When we first built it, each man would do his shift every afternoon for free, and he might only have to do that once a fortnight. You'd just go on and open the bar about 4:30 or 5 when everybody would knock off work, and you'd stay there till 7 or 8 and then close it. And then of a weekend, often of a weekend, there'd be a get-together, a bit of a dance. The old-time waltzes, which were the main ones we knew then, I suppose, or more easily accessible on records.
Home life and social life was very good indeed. And in the Western Highlands there were small plantations, 200 or 300 acres, and consequently fairly close. I mean, 3 or 4 miles between plantations. It was a very, very marvellous group of people there. We were going out 2 or 3 times a week. You'd go out to dinner and you'd have barbecues, and there was tennis and swimming and so forth. And as the situation improved economically, people started putting their swimming pools and build their tennis courts and so forth. And there were horses, and they used to play polo cross and so on and so forth, you see.
And the planters were, of course, another very elite social group in New Ireland. They considered that they were the aristocracy of the white community. They were the bastion of the KVN Club, and they really did live and behave as if they were members of the British Raj before the Second World War. They usually had a great string of local people to act as servants. They would not be seen to do any manual work at all in the running of their plantations. They were very autocratic, and this, of course, carried over to their behaviour to the white community as well. It was considered a privilege to be invited to a planter's house. Well, they regarded it as a privilege. The ironic part about this was that most of them were very poor, in fact. Most were plantation managers, either for carpenters or BPs or New Guinea Company and did not own their own plantations. Even those who owned their own plantations weren't particularly financially well off, but they certainly behaved as if they were lords of the manor.
When an Australian family went to live in a plantation house, they also entered a peculiar institution. They seemed very conscious of unwritten rules that said how the planter, his wife and children should behave. Many of the rules said how the servants should be treated. A few of the white settlers were able to accept a string of domestic and personal servants as though to the manor born. They gloried in dominance. Many played the part of the master. They ordered and disciplined the servants, but they were always a little embarrassed or defensive about it. And a few formed effective relationships in spite of the barriers of language, race, and unwritten rules.
Aropa Plantation, where we were for 8 years, it was a lovely big home, enormous big home, probably one of the most attractive in the islands. Beautifully made with a big archway between the lounge and dining room, and our dining room table sat 8. And it was during the time that my husband managed Aropa, it was owned by the New Guinea Biological Foundation, and we did entertain people from all parts of the world, and everybody from the administrator at the time, all the different directors of different departments. So we had quite a fine dining room, and we had at that time in the house and garden 5, I suppose you'd call them servants. I have never used that word servant, because perhaps I did have 5, but they were always my helpmates. I always worked with them, the same with my husband. And I think for special evenings, they all did wear white lap-laps. And they were thrilled about it, their special lap-laps. They were always happy if someone special was coming. We always had 2 or 3 sets of lap-laps for perhaps daytime, nighttime, and special dinner guests. If we were having the administrator and some other guests, or people from England or different countries. Aropa did have a certain atmosphere, and people used to remark on this.
I would knock off about 4 o'clock in the afternoon and ride my horse back to my house to be met by my horse boy standing by the front gate. It was part of his responsibilities to wait there for me to arrive. I would get off my horse and throw the reins to him. It was his job to take the horse away and unsaddle it and clean it. I would walk up the steps of my front veranda and to be met by my 2 houseboys who assisted me off with my boots and then served afternoon tea to me on the veranda. White bread tomato sandwiches, as I recall, with a pot of tea, and I would stay there until about 5:30 or 6. At that time of the afternoon, it used to rain without fail, particularly in the wet season. It used to rain for about an hour or so, and I would sit there on the veranda reading, watching the rain. Then I would go in and have a shower and clean up and leave the bathroom something of a mess, walk into my bedroom where my clothes for the evening would be laid out. That is, a fresh pair of white trousers and a fresh white shirt. I'd put those clothes on and go back into the bathroom to do my hair to find that the bathroom had been cleaned up in my absence. I'd then sit down and turn on Radio Australia and listen to the radio for a while and have a glass of sherry and when the tune, which maybe even now signals the onset of the Radio Australian news, when that tune commenced, it was a signal for the houseboys to bring in my meal. And on the dot of 7, I would sit down at my table and have my soup served to me by the boys that lived in the house. One of the guys standing near the table to replenish my water jug when it became empty. And I actually lived in that absurd fashion for the whole of the 2 years that I was there. That's how the white men ate, if they were married and living in company, or if they, like myself, were living alone. On the odd occasions when I used to entertain, meals would be very formal. When I was entertained by other plantation workers, meals would be very formal. Of course, there was no social contact with the nationals in New Guinea at all. They used to work for us. We didn't mix with them socially, except to the extent that living near Sagiri School, the Sagiri Education Centre, there was a fairly good cricket team down there, and I recall that we used to play cricket against them. But that was the only social contact that I recall throughout the whole of the 2 years that I was living there. That's how life was. I was told how I should behave, and in order to serve my employers well, I behaved the way I was taught. Until, of course, I realised the whole thing was nonsense, and I think it was that realisation that ultimately prompted me to leave and make a career in Australia.
They had almost no contact with the village people. I am generalising, there were exceptions, but the exceptions stood out. Most of them lived between their plantation house and the Kavieng Club, and they really didn't know too much about what was going on in the villages. They certainly knew nothing about what people felt and the way people responded to things, because they just didn't have the contact. They didn't see them as individual people to start with anyway. So they had no capacity from which to start understanding them. They lived in an isolated little world. They mixed very largely with each other. They didn't have too much to do with government people, or certainly not mission people. They lived in their own little enclosed social world, on dreams of the glories of the past, really. Some of them lived in quite fascinating state. I remember one old lady whose family owned quite a string of plantations in New Ireland. Her own home plantation was like something out of the south of America. She had a big white house on the hill, at the bottom of the hill. She had a row of little white plantation labourers' houses, which of course inside were quite incredible, you know, a few planks of wood for beds and no windows and very dark, but they looked good from the outside. They looked scenic, one might say.
But for most planters and their families, the concept of the easy life in the big white house up on the hill was far removed from daily reality.
I happened to arrive just prior to the first wet season when we were there, and people were saying to me, "You'll just get there in time." And I couldn't understand why people were saying this. "You'll just make it." I went to a place called Palmelmel by plane, and then I was taken by a little launch to the plantation. People in Rabaul first, then the airstrip, and then on the launch said, "You'll just make it." And I couldn't understand this. And I thought, well, you know, I'm used to rain here in the tropics. But of course, when this rain started, I knew what they meant. I think the first month we had 60 inches, and then the next month 80. It rained, the gauge overflowing, and you know, just couldn't count the amount of rain that we would get. And sometimes it would rain for 3 weeks, just almost stopping at times, and then it just falling out of the sky again. But then we also had our dry period of time when the weather changed right around to the northwest. The wet season was in the southeast. And during this time, my husband wasn't able to get the cocoa into the dryer, so he decided to build a bridge. And everyone was terrific. They only had this tractor. There was no other machinery. So they made rope vines and pulled the big logs out of the bush, 60-foot logs. And it was, the wet had started, and all the men worked with my husband. I'd go down with the children and watch them, and they kept singing. They were so pleased to be doing this, but they were working in the rain, building this bridge. And they built the bridge, and I think we've got 2 loads of cocoa in over it, and the rain was coming in heavily, and my husband was saying to me, "Isn't it wonderful? We're right. We've got the bridge finished, and the rain is here." And in the morning, the people came shouting around, calling to us, "Come quickly, come quickly." And we ran down it. Every stick of the bridge had gone. There wasn't even one bit of decking left. The rain had just come, or I think we had 37 inches of rain in 36 hours, something like that. And of course, everything, those 60-foot logs just were swept away like matchsticks. So that was our bridge.
First they planted the coconuts, and of course the rainfall there was over 300 inches of rain a year, most of which fell between August and October, and it didn't suit the coconuts. And quite soon after Father came up and settled there in 1917, he started taking the coconuts out and planting rubber, and rubber did very well. grew like bilio with this rainfall. And in 1924, the price of rubber went up, and it really looked as though everything was going to be fine. But just at that moment, Father's partners in Melbourne gave up, and he and Loudon, the BNG man, and a third man bought into the plantation. Father was rather pleased because now he was only a third of the plantation instead of the 13th or whatever he'd had before. But then no sooner had they got themselves really going and a little bit of money was beginning to trickle in than the bottom fell out of the rubber market. And that was the end of Father. He couldn't cope with it anymore. So we came back. That was 1929. So in effect, Father did what he wanted to do. He had his pioneering experience, but he didn't make any money out of it.
In the next program, Muster, Me Like Work, we'll deal with the planters' daily routine and how they organised and recruited their Papua New Guinean labour lines. In The Boat Came Every 6 Weeks, you heard the voices of Penelope Hope, Cliff Batt, Jeff Elworthy, Norman Sandford, Merle Wall, James Seto, Ken Douglas, Jim Lay, Tom Cole, Lynn Watt, and Malcolm McGregor. Comment was by Dr. Hank Nelson, fellow in the Department of Pacific and Southeast Asian History at the Australian National University.